I don't know about you, but sometimes when I start thinking about how to plan for not just things in my business, but in my personal life, there's always this thought about, do I have to plan 5,000 different scenarios? Or do I just need to stay focused in the moment? Or how do I stay focused in the moment when I'm always worrying about all the ways I have messed up in the past and I don't want to replicate it in the future? This is really sticky for a lot of us, because for a lot of us, we struggle with that. And as a result, we either avoid things that challenge us or we procrastinate. And then we feel miserable about ourselves in the process and nothing gets done. And this is such a tough one that even I struggle with at times. Hi, my name is Denise Lee and I'm a life coach specializing in traumas and addictions. And I am so focused on understanding ourselves so that we can be able to do great things and build phenomenal organizations and not just our business, but transforming our lives. And that's why I brought in with me today Graham Norris. He is an organizational psychologist and futurist, and he owns a consultancy practice called Foresight Psychology. And he is so dedicated on helping people understand their power, their potential, and how they can plan for the future without losing their minds in the process. And we had such a great conversation about awareness, understanding motivations, and really practical tips for you to be able to plan effectively without losing your mind in your process. So if you're interested in that kind of conversation, you're going to really love this. And if you're interested in more conversations just like this, make sure you hit that follow, subscribe button. So as soon as new episodes drop, which is usually on Mondays and Wednesdays, you'll be able to listen to it lickety split. And without further delay, let's get into it. Hey, Graham, how are you doing today?
Really well, Denise. Thank you very much. And how are you?
I'm doing good. You know, before we talk, there was a lot of weird things going on in your part of this over side of your pond. Am I saying it right? Your side of the pond. I know you're in UK. I'm here in Texas. And there was a lot of uncertainty about a very special family. And we were chatting a little bit about that. And people were a little worried.
That's right. Well, I live not too far from Windsor Castle, so I probably should have just gone down there and had a look through the window. It's sad to hear the problems that Kate's facing. They attract a lot of attention, but we'll have to see what happens, because her father-in-law also sick as well. So tough time for the royal family.
You know, we as human beings have a really hard time with the future and what's going to happen to not just obviously the royal family, but just ourselves and people in general. And I really am excited about your expertise in foresight psychology and understanding about how we can plan for the future while staying anchored in the present. And so before we kind of get more into that conversation, would you kindly introduce yourself to the audience and let them know a little bit about why they should trust you on this issue?
Sure. No problem at all. So I'm an organizational psychologist and futurist. And what I really focus on is how we think about the future, because really all we do every day is make decisions, and all decisions are about the future. And we're increasingly being asked to make decisions that have longer and longer term implications. And of course, the people we are today and the companies that we work for and that we run today are a product of decisions we made yesterday and last week and last year. And those decisions, the decisions we make, don't always have the best interests or a very clear understanding about the implications over the long term. So what I research and what I talk about is really the challenges of thinking more deeply into the future and how we can overcome those.
This is straight from your lips. Well, your written word there. I'm looking at some of your works right now, and quote, "When we try to think of the future, we can't imagine anything much different from today. Research shows, in fact, that when you think of your future self, it activates parts of the brain usually reserved for strangers." I want to pause there and think about it. Why are we thinking about things and people specifically that we only have just maybe a surface level, or maybe even what we think we know about people, rather than ourselves when we're projecting into the future?
So it's interesting. So this concept of self that we have is a psychological concept, and neuroscientists have looked into what that means in terms of brain scans and activity in the brain. And it does show that when we think about ourselves, it really does engage certain parts of the brain. And when we think about other things, animals or other people, then it engages different parts of the brain. So this research that was done looking at, you know, how we use our brains to think about ourselves and other people, they then asked the participants to then, okay, imagine yourself in the future. I don't know the exact time frame, but several years into the future. And rather than keeping that sense of self and engaging those parts of the brain where we think about ourselves, it started to use other parts of the brain that we're using to think about other stuff. And of course, we will very much think about ourselves as being the most important. We're the center of the world, the center of our worlds. And other people are, they could be more or less important to us. But obviously, we're going to think more about ourselves first. And so this creates a bit of a challenge, because, of course, we have to live in the future as well. We have to be that future self at some point. And it's just, so it's not that healthy to really regard that person as a stranger, because that just means when push comes to shove, are we going to do something for our future self in terms of being healthy or eating better or making smart financial decisions? Or are we just going to sit on the sofa and do what our present self wants to do and, you know, eat Oreos and watch Netflix? So there's another complicated psychological concept, and I call it the Magoo effect. And if you remember the cartoon character Mr. Magoo, he had extreme myopia. You can really only see things very close to him. And it's the same with people. Things very close to us seem real. They seem concrete. They seem tangible. And we take them seriously. But things further away, and that could be physical distance, but also in time, they seem more abstract, less tangible, less important to us. And so that means we really do see the future as less important. That in a nutshell is what that research is talking to.
I like that, the Magoo effect, because I do remember Mr. Magoo. And, you know, you bring up a really interesting point about the myopia, in the sense of when we want to launch something new, whether it be a product launch, we want to scale and expand our business, we want to do something new and innovative. Oftentimes, the fear of comparison about what we see other people doing stops us straight in our tracks. We just think, well, other people must be already ahead of us. We're late to the game. It's not going to be good for anybody else to use. And we just spin this narrative and we stop the momentum before it can even like start.
Absolutely. And a lot of that is looking at the situation right now. So we're making comparisons with what we see right now, and we can imagine all kinds of good or bad things, but we will tend to see the uncertainty of not knowing whether our innovation is going to be successful or not in uncertain terms. And we are naturally scared of uncertainty. Other research shows that people would rather get an electric shock than have the chance of getting an electric shock. It's the uncertainty that is more stressful. And so for that example you gave in terms of doing things that will have a long-term implication, and then we start to overthink it, a lot of that is then losing sight of that vision about what we want to achieve, which could have been compelling and motivating, but starts to get kind of fuzzy because of this Magoo effect. It's not so clear. And we get drawn to the present, which is a little bit clearer, and our worries and our concerns and all those thoughts that jump into our heads. And so it's really another symptom of what really is a short-term thinking that can paralyze our decision-making.
I don't know which study you mentioned, but I'm thinking about the white room study. There could be another one where you're sitting in a room and it's just a white room with nothing but a chair and a buzzer. And they said, hey, like, you just sit here, but if you want to get shocked, press the button. And it was amazing. Most men would rather, I think it was like two-thirds men to women, would rather get shocked than sitting alone with their thoughts.
Yeah, pretty. I'm familiar with that one. It's pretty scary, you know. People being alone with their thoughts, people being bored, and it's getting worse and worse. People you see now addicted to getting their smartphones out and checking stuff, and it's a shame because when you do work with people and you get them to think more deeply into the future, and you get them to imagine motivating, compelling visions of their own futures. Then it starts to put that they're not interested in the phone anymore. Whatever's going on the phone just seems trivial and unimportant because they've got such a much more important purpose. But it's difficult to hold on to that. You easily get drawn back into the noisy present because it's addictive. It's addictive to be thinking about the ultra short term, as I call it.
I'm sorry, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole, but I just have to say this because it's on my mind because you mentioned social media. So I'm going to blame you in advance for this.
Absolutely.
So there was a study about the average amount of time that people spend on different social media platforms. And they went through Reddit and Quora and all these other places. And they would say, would you believe the top two places that people are spend the most time, literally up to an hour and a half a day, was TikTok at an hour or some change, and then followed by YouTube. And the reason why it was so enthralling for people was because it was short, fast clips that didn't get people to think introspectively or even about themselves. It was just from one pivot point to another to another.
It's addictive, isn't it? And I even find myself getting sucked into some of those things as well. And it's interesting to reflect on, what is it exactly? Because a lot of it's just trash. It's not really, you know, it's clearly not getting me anywhere. But it is very compelling. And, you know, the fact is that we do spend most of our cognitive firepower, our cognitive energy, in this immediate term future. So we're constantly trying to predict what's going to happen in the next few seconds, including what we're going to say next in the next few seconds. And we don't normally think, we may think as far ahead as dinner time. But we don't even normally think about tomorrow that much. We normally have to sit down and very deliberately look at our calendars for tomorrow to even think about tomorrow, let alone next week, next month, next year. And we are very almost conditioned by our evolution to think just in this immediate term future. And the result is anything that draws us back into that feels comfortable because that's where it's safe and certain. And our to-do lists end up the same way. You can have all kinds of ideas about what your dreams and aspirations about what you want to achieve in the future. And you may even sort of break that down into some kind of action plan. And then, you know, put some things on a to-do list. But eventually your to-do list will gradually get junked up with other short-term stuff because the obstacles to your dream or vision are much closer to now. You can see them. You can feel them. You can add them to a to-do list. You can cross them off, and it feels good. But after you've got one obstacle out the way, you then don't move on to your vision, your long-term goal. You move on to another obstacle because it feels safer. It feels more certain, and it feels more satisfying to cross that off the list, even if that only means dealing with an email or watching some rubbish on YouTube to educate yourself or looking up something on Wikipedia. It's just much more comforting and much more satisfying to do those things than to really spend your life, you know, thinking about the long-term future. It's a real challenge.
This is, again, I'm quoting you. People like to think in terms of categories rather than 50 shades of gray. Yet complexity means uncertainty, and we are allergic to uncertainty. So we reject the complexity. The result is we go binary on it. Complex things are either good or bad, right or wrong, harmful or helpful. We find solace in the extremes. And once we've picked a side, we need to defend it vigorously. The more extreme, the more certainty we feel, and the more difficult it is to accept the complexity. I read that and I was like nodding my head so much. I felt like a piss dispenser because we see it even when, I mean, I'm a mother. I don't know if you're a parent as well, but you know, when my son was young, And my mind, when I saw my kid going outside playing with unknown people, I was going doomsday scenario about all the ways I have to protect him from forces that were beyond my control. And because of that, I couldn't be present and really aware of how I was feeling and what he really needed in the moment. And we see it in business time where we're so focused on maintaining our reputation, we don't see how the people feel disaffected, as an example.
Absolutely. You know, we have to, you know, our minds have to make assumptions about the world, which does sometimes mean simplifying and taking positions and then sticking with those, because we can't wake up every morning with a blank slate and then, you know, with a baby's mindset and start exploring and coming up with new impressions and new understandings about the world. But it is also worth every now and again being aware, as you say, being conscious of your own responses to the world and testing them and saying, are these assumptions still correct? Is my understanding of the world still valid? Is it still useful? Is it still serving a purpose to help me think more productively about the future and make better decisions about that? A real challenge, because you can't do that for all assumptions all the time. You have to pick and choose. But it's worth raising to the surface of your consciousness and awareness some of those assumptions that you may subconsciously feel a bit uncomfortable with, that maybe aren't quite so valid anymore.
You said that making great decisions is hard when you're obviously overwhelmed by decisions. You need to make decisions with increasingly long-term implications. You have too much information on which to base your decisions, and there seems to be just so much uncertainty. And I just want to pause and zoom in specifically on the note that you made through your literature about the too much information. And entrepreneurs, we want so much information. Give me the scenario for this scenario. Oh, if that scenario doesn't work, give me another scenario. And we're going down this analysis paralysis and nothing is getting done. People are waiting for us to hit the trigger button, but nothing's happening.
Absolutely. And it's a weird part of our times. When I was a kid, if I wanted to find something out, I'd have to go to a library and find a book to go look it up. And for most of human history, it was pretty much like that. If you wanted to find something out, you could go and observe it yourself nearby, or you'd have to go ask someone, you know, a village elder about their experience. And that was it. You'd very quickly exhaust all avenues, all sources of information. And then you just have to pull the trigger on something. Whereas now we have almost pretty much limitless amounts of information. So you have to make decisions about what you're going to make a decision about, what kind of information you need to make a decision, where a decision about when you've got enough information. And it just goes on and on and on. And we have a paradox. The paradox of information is uncertainty is an itch that cannot be scratched. And we try to resolve that by getting more information. And that used to be okay because there wasn't much information to be had. But now, because there's so much information, the more information we get, the more uncertainty it creates. Because we realize, actually, there's more we could know. There are more options than we realized. There's more opportunity. And so it really creates a big problem. And we're almost, it's interesting now in this, everybody's focused on artificial intelligence, because the promise of artificial intelligence is that it should be able to curate all of this information for us to a certain extent, that we don't actually have to try to stuff it all into our heads and process it all ourselves. But of course, we're still not quite there yet. And the amount of information about artificial intelligence is really overwhelming now. It's just way too much to deal with. And so we've almost like accelerated the information production that we're supposed to try to figure out what's important and what's not. And hopefully, you know, when it gets, you know, to two giddy heights of information overwhelm, then the technology will hopefully be enough to help us get over it. But it's tough. Information is a real complicated problem to deal with. And for some people, it's a real challenge, because they will just continually search for more information to try to resolve that uncertainty.
Oh,
I'm just thinking about which angle I want to respond, because it was so good what you talked about. You know, I get a lot of emails from different people about different things. I'm just not going into the details about it. But anyway, I've been getting a series. Have you ever noticed when you get a series of stuff and it's like, wait a minute, it doesn't seem like a human being wrote this. It doesn't seem like, and anyway, I've been getting these emails and I realize it's not even like a human being writing it, but it's because it's so formulaic, it's so scripted. My mind, in the process of reading it, my mind becomes negative, suspicious, judgmental, overcritical. And there's no creativity whatsoever in my mind at that moment. It's just like, let's just shut it down and push it out of our way. And I realize in the process of that suspicion, because we're being flooded with so much content, and now artificially driven content, we're limiting our abilities. And I know you talk so much about imagination and creativity. It's being stifled. And I even had to catch myself at the moment going, okay, I know it's a bot, but let's think creatively about how we can use this information.
It's an interesting point you raised there, Denise, about that, the stifling of imagination. It's, to some extent, I think it can be stifling in imagination. I think one of the things about the generative AI that we've seen was certainly when I started playing around with ChatGPT, I was expecting it to be like some kind of souped up Google. And it was just going to be able to, like I was saying before, kind of curate the world's information and just give me some answers. And it's not very good at that. It makes stuff up, hallucinates, right? But what I find it is actually quite good at is creating ideas or stimulating my thinking. Because what you can do is you can actually ask it to provoke you or come up with or synthesize ideas. And for me, one of the interesting things is at the moment, or roughly at the moment, it's drawing from a pool or a lake of human knowledge that is as pure as it's ever going to be. Because day by day, every day, it gets polluted with regurgitated or reprocessed information that's gone through artificial intelligence and has gone back into this pool, rather than having humans contribute to that pool of imagination. So it's unfortunate that I think increasingly it will stifle the imagination of humans. I think at the moment we're probably in a golden age where it might actually be quite useful to bring together lots of ideas. I've used it to brainstorm things, and it's come up with things I never would have imagined, and it's combined ideas that I never would have combined myself, and it's excellent at doing that. But I think in the long term, or certainly in the medium term, it's going to get nasty. It's going to get ugly, because it can produce meaningless rubbish at scales we can't even imagine, and you're going to get emails and all kinds of content. We see people very proudly saying they've created these websites that have been refined, you know, to within an inch of their lives to be, you know, SEO, you know, uber successful at attracting clicks from Google. And of course, that's not healthy. It's not the way we want to end up. But hopefully, that's just a medium term problem, and we're going to emerge into something more useful in the long term. But how long's long term? That's the question.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we're definitely at the inception process. And yeah, to your point earlier, I mean, I have seen wonderful applications of AI. For example, there was an article in Wall Street Journal a while back that a full-blown law was created in Peru for some water conservation effort, right down with like contingencies, and they saved like thousands of pesos and all this money because humans weren't filling through their brains and like taking 5-hour lunch breaks and all this stuff. And so I'm not sitting here and saying that all of, you know, AI is useless. It's just, we're getting to a point where if we're going to be thinking future, right, and we're going to be aware and present, we shouldn't lose our capacity for discernment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, I do see there will be challenges, and we will lose what we want to gain from AI. We will also lose things too. And that's true with every step changing technology. A lot of people make comparisons with calculators, and so that we're not that good at sort of calculating things in our heads anymore, which is true. So we gain something with the scale that we can calculate things with calculators, and we've lost something with the cognitive capacity to, when the calculator is not there, to be able to compute things in our heads effectively. So absolutely, there will be, as with everything, winners and losers, and that includes in our cognitive capacities as well.
So people are listening right now and they're like, Graham, like, I need to finally like think forward. I need to not get lost in analysis paralysis. I need to be able to just stay present and aware. How do I do that? We talk about AI. That's awesome. But how do we, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a leader. I'm a business owner. I'm a visionary. How do I do that without having my mind splinter in 6,000 different directions? I'll try and meet my payroll on Friday. Fictitious scenario.
Sure. So one of the things I think of is when we have dreams and scenarios, and probably I would say entrepreneurs are probably a little bit better at this than average people, but particularly in bigger corporations. But when we have a vision, and I touched on this earlier on talking about the Magoo effect, but that vision, we often think it's a good one, you know, to save the world in some respect or another. However, we say, okay, we want to save the world, but then we come back down to today, sitting in my office or in my home, saving the world doesn't seem quite so real. And it's because that idea about saving the world, it is kind of abstract, because you maybe haven't even put a time frame against it. And so one thing I think it's important is making that vision vibrant and vivid and real, because you want to make it seem as concrete as the things you see right in front of you. There are dangers in that as well, but what the danger I see is that vision just stays a vision. So one thing is putting a time frame on. When do we want to realize our particular goals and objectives and dreams and aspirations? And then really color it in. It usually ends up as just a sketch. A lot of vision statements are just a statement, like a sentence. But to really color that in and to say, okay, what does it look like? What does it sound like? What does it smell like? What does it feel like? And the more detailed, the better, because the more real it is, the more attached, the more relevant, the more you can feel emotionally connected to it. And that's how you make it motivating and compelling. And that's how you stay driven on that course to make it real. The other thing I think is, I talk about it sounds a very practical thing, but to-do lists. You know, I mentioned it earlier, to-do lists get junked up with all sorts of other stuff. Burn the to-do list. You know, to-do lists usually don't have any time frames stuck on them at all. And so they just sit there. You much more easily put on some short-term thing and then take it off again than deal with those long-term things that you don't really know how to do and seem a bit difficult and a little bit less concrete and are all to do with that future self that you know, that stranger you don't really care about. And so I always talk about burning the to-do list and sticking whatever is important in your calendar and then doing those things. You'll be much, much more productive. I always say the smartest people have calendars, not to-do lists.
I want to talk about keeping things vibrant and real, because I don't know about you, but a lot of the ideas that I have in my mind about doing certain things didn't manifest, but it started something else that I never considered. And I think as we're talking about being imaginative, right? I also want to say, like, can't we be a little flexible that even as we plan things, it may not turn out the way we want it to be, but at least we try thinking about it. And I think a lot of people get bummed out. They're like, well, I can't think of anything. Well, maybe we need to think about what we want to think about, and then we can circle the wagons until we land on something. Does that make any sense? Like that idea of being flexible? Yeah.
Absolutely right, Denise. And this is one of the reasons plans fail, is because there's no flexibility built in. There's a very linear view of the future that's locked in there, and then we will ignore information that contradicts that vision of that singular vision of the future, and we will grasp onto any information that seems to be confirming it. And of course, that's very risky, because that whatever expectation you have of the future is almost certain not to be correct, We can't predict the future. It simply never works. And so what I talk about is there is a bit of a paradox there, because ideally we think in terms of scenarios so that we can understand the different possibilities that the future offers us, based on the understanding that none of those will actually happen, but they will, elements of each scenario that we think of will come to pass. The point about creating a compelling, motivating vision is it gives you direction. And so a little bit like, you know, having strong opinions lightly held, it's about having a direction that you find motivating and compelling, but it is also flexible. Because the problem is we often think, okay, I asked you to create that vision, it's motivating, it's vivid, it's vibrant, you've colored it in, right? You should really do that again tomorrow. You should try it on again for size tomorrow to see if it still fits. You still feel the same way. Now, how often you do that is kind of up to you, but it's a dynamic process. It needs to be revisited frequently, because you can try on different futures for size by getting into that kind of detail to make different possibilities come to life. You can then say, do I like that? Does it feel right? Does it feel good? Do I feel motivated to achieve that? But that's a question you need to keep asking, because the future will change, you will change. And you will say, actually, that's just not where I want to head anymore.
I think a lot of us are stuck, going back to Mr. Magoo, like this guy was so crusty and just stuck in his ways, and it was always just one way, and if this don't work out, we're a failure, and don't bother trying it again. And I think a lot of us don't try to try things again and again and see and be a little flexible, is because we think so seriously about ourselves, so seriously, as if we don't do this perfectly the first time, we're losers. Or you should just shut up, chop, and just quit. And that's really hard on the mind if we're constantly putting all that pressure on ourselves to be perfect, excellent, do harder, try everything with excellence 24/7. I mean, I think I realize a lot of us aren't creative. We can't color in anything, because we're putting so much pressure on ourselves.
You know, I put out a post on LinkedIn recently, and it talked about the fear of messing up. And that in itself can be quite debilitating. And I think the statistic was, I think it's 57% of executives have, you know, worried about messing something up and making the wrong decision. Now, this is almost like a societal norm now, is that, you know, you've got to be right. And there's a massive emphasis on being right and being wrong. And this is this kind of binary way of we look at the world, is things are right or wrong, and we make good decisions or bad decisions. It's not. There may be better decisions or worse decisions, but you know, the fact is life, because you don't know what's going to happen. Life is just a big experiment, and you are there to make lots of experiments in the meantime. And those experiments could go any number of ways. And you know, the problem is getting attached to a particular outcome. Now, obviously, you probably conduct experiments hoping that it gets a, you know, particular outcome rather than another one. But you have to go into that experiment accepting the fact you may get several different outcomes that aren't the most desired one. And so this spirit of experimentation, I think, is quite important, you know, to try to view what you're doing. It's just a test. You're testing out a hypothesis. Maybe it will work. Maybe it won't. I mean, I used to tell my teams when I was operating teams, I have 100 ideas, you know, and 99% of them are rubbish. You know, my task is to try to find the good one and then iterate on that. But by accepting the fact that 99% of my ideas are going to be rubbish, you know, I'm like, oh, there's another rubbish one. Okay, fine. Oh, there's another rubbish one. Okay, where's this gold that I'm looking for? Eventually you find it, and then you can really tap into that.
I just want to preface what I'm about to say is that no one's saying that you shouldn't take yourself seriously. No one's saying that you shouldn't try to do the best. But I think for a lot of us, we can't really think into the future because we're taking ourselves and other people way too seriously. Like super seriously, as if like the whole weight is on our shoulder or the other person's shoulder. And if this doesn't work out according to plan, then our lives, our projects, our business, everything that matters most to us will just go up in this fiery pit of hell. Like, and then they're wondering why you're stressed, and you're wondering why you're anxious, and why you're procrastinating your volume. Like, yeah, you'd be stressed and anxious too if you think that everything is riding on this particular person or moment or activity or task.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I know it's tough, and you see it in lots of other worlds as well. I mean, you know, academics, for example, who almost by definition shouldn't be attached to the outcome of their research, will nevertheless have a hypothesis, test it out. They'll get it proved, and then they'll be like, great. And then they'll write books about it, and they'll become totally attached to, you know, to the result of this research. And so when someone comes up with some research that suggests something otherwise, they get very defensive about it, even though they're supposed to, you know, by rights, be, you know, completely agnostic about about the outcomes of their research. But they get very, very attached to it. And it's difficult. It's difficult to let go and to be able to not attach your identity to the outcomes of your decisions, whereas in fact those two things are very different. We are who we are, and our decisions are our decisions. They're separate things.
So you may have heard of like the four different types of learners: auditory, reading, kinesthetic, visual. And it was hilarious. I always thought, or there's probably more types of learning. The point I'm trying to make is everyone has been taught that you're learning based on your natural learning style. And we wrap around our identity. Well, I'm a visual learner. No, I'm an auditory learner. And do you believe the study that created that, the different types of learning, was based on a subjective observation of what people said? Like, it's literally in the text saying that. But we have created a culture where we box ourselves in into what our ideas of how we learn and process and grow. And it's like I'm banging my head against the wall going like, no wonder why we feel so rigid. It's right down to how we think we should observe our reality.
Absolutely. And everything, honestly, everything is subjective. You know, no matter how many numbers you put against things, you know, the way those numbers are chosen and everything else is a very subjective thing. And, you know, personality is exactly the same. You can't even find a really good definition of the word personality. And when you look at all the different words we use to describe personality, including introversion, extroversion, all these other things, you'll find actually that that's a very subjective thing as well. And you go to different cultures with different languages, and they'll have different ways of describing personality, and they'll have different flavors about how they're going to describe, you know, what does it, you know, introversion mean or extroversion mean. And yet, you know, people do get very attached to this. Some of the earlier personality assessments would basically give you a type. You'd be one of four types, just like these learning types. And then people would ask you to put like a red brick on your desk to say, I'm this personality type. This is how you got to talk to me. Right? Now, of course, it's not, life is not so simple, and people are not so simple. And so, you know, I think when we look at these things, it's much better to see the nuances, to understand the differences between people, because people are different. They certainly are. And these frameworks that we use in terms of learning frameworks or personality frameworks are useful to understand them, as long as you don't hold on to them too tightly. When you start to really, you know, hold them too tightly and that they, you know, attach to your identity, then the usefulness starts to break down.
I like that. It's just a tool, but not a crutch.
Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned earlier about, let's just forget about this to-do list thing and put it on a calendar. Now, I'm just speaking about me, okay? As I say this, I used to feel giddy when my calendar was full of stuff. And like the only time I could like take a break was for use the bathroom. But oh, good. Appointment, 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 appointment. And I know a lot of us who are creative, innovative people want to feel busy. How do we organize our time, but not glorifying things that lead to our neurosis? I'm trying to say that.
I guess I'm probably the opposite of you. I'm like, when I see an empty calendar day, I'm like, yeah, I can go do something else. But Absolutely. You know, you have to look at yourself and understand what kind of person you are and whether you're just filling up your calendar with stuff. It's just a proxy for a junked up to-do list, you know, and asking yourself, you know, what is on there? Everything, you know, another way of doing it actually is to make sure, okay, you put something on your calendar or even to-do list, and then you write after it, how is that attached to your long-term goal, your long-term aspiration? And if you struggle there, if you have to think about it for too long, or if it's a bit of a too long of a windy connection, say, do you know what? If I cross this off, another test is, if I cross this off the list and just didn't do it, is that going to slow me down getting to where I want to get to? So, you know, there's a lot of tools and tricks like that one to try to, you know, unfortunately, the word is discipline, to discipline ourselves. It's not a very nice word, but I think, you know, that's really what it comes down to. Is to discipline ourselves to think more clearly about the future.
Okay. I didn't think I was going to mention this, but I'm going to mention it because you did mention discipline. Because for a lot of us, that is like the Pavlov's dog bell. That's ding, 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 ding. I don't want to be disciplined because it reminds me of my time in uni, for those of you guys who listen in the UK, college, all those places. And it reminds me of some strict dogmatic person that always put the thumb on my creativity, never got me to be innovated. I felt stifled, and anything that sniffs of discipline or structure, I gotta push it away. It's disgusting, virulent to me. So for those who are listening and they brand themselves as a free thinker or creative spirit, free spirit, and like, I don't want discipline. Can we like maybe repackage it in a way that's more palatable to them because of those kind of experiences?
Sure. I mean, you know, when I think of discipline, yeah, I do think of, you know, headmasters with sticks that they used to beat the children. You know, maybe I'd say a couple of things. It's good to get a different perspective there, Denise. I mean, one is, you know, there's got to be balance with everything, right? It's always gray. There's always gray areas. And so if we're always one thing and never anything else, we're never going to get, you know, we're not going to get where we want to get to. We have to be mixtures of different things in different situations. You know, and the other thing is there's discipline. Yes, it has this maybe unpleasant connotation, right? But even your most creative person, does the most creative person just want to sit there and think about stuff? Or do they want to make stuff happen, right? And so, yeah, if you just want to sit there and think about it, that's fine. But discipline is really only getting us to do the things that we're not necessarily 100% good at doing, right? Because that's the bit that's missing. So for those who are good at thinking about stuff and coming up with creative ideas, although easy, the things they find easy, right? They don't need discipline for that, but they may need discipline to actually get things done. Whereas other people, very good at getting things done, very structured, they got to-do lists and stuff. They will need the discipline to put all that to one side and start to think out of the box, to start to think creatively. That's where they need to apply the discipline. And so it's really just finding, you know, what are you good at? Where do you need the discipline?
You know, Stephen Covey, right? His son, like Steve M H, they all have those initials in their name. But anyways, his son wrote this book called The Speed of Trust. And in the book, there was a little excerpt and he was talking about how he was you know, how they have different ratings of slow, black, blue, whatever. And he was saying, I was a blue, meaning that on the surface, it seemed like I'm a good skier, but I really wasn't. What I did was I got to the range of a slope and of difficulty, and I just kind of coasted there. I didn't really try to challenge myself. I didn't really try to try new paths. And as a result, I never got past a certain grade. And I think for a lot of us, we find a lot of pride on, okay, I've arrived here in my discipline or my thinking, but I don't really want to push past it because I'm really slaying it. I'm really doing good right here at this level.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I think that's a common problem. We try to find, you know, a good place and get comfortable there and then start to appreciate that. But, you know, that's not motivating after a while, right? You know, when you've achieved a goal, it loses all its motivating capacities. And so, you know, I don't know about, I haven't read Stephen Covey's son's book. You're ahead of me there. You know, in terms of pushing yourself, you know, I've done various things in my life where I was like, I had a goal, maybe, you know, quite a big, hairy, audacious goal, and I've achieved that. And then, but I spent too long appreciating, you know, we always got to appreciate where we are, but I spent too long appreciating it. Because you know, and I didn't spend enough time thinking about, okay, what's the next thing that's going to motivate me? You always do need another thing. You do need something else to keep motivating you. You can't just expect that to come out of the blue. You've got to go look for it. And so that's what I would say to that. But now I'm inspired to go read his book. I'm fine.
Don't bother. The Covey is just be writing books every other moment. Like, call a new book pops. It's like C.S. Lewis. I mean, you spend your rest of your career reading those books. The point I'm trying to make is that for a lot of us human beings, right, we just want to keep patting ourselves on the back, keep saying, like, well, remember when we did that last week? Let's just stay there and like keep feeling the glory from that experience.
It's important to appreciate. I mean, you know, the a lot of people get on this sort of hedonic treadmill, a rat race, going to always sacrifice now to try to achieve something later. Whereas it's also good to appreciate things now. But, you know, at the same time, I think people do need some objectives, some goals, some aspirations that can drive them forward.
This is such a good conversation. Because I think for a lot of us who are driven, we never realize that there's a little bit more in us to go. And I think of it as in terms of like my car, that even when my car says it's E, there's always more fuel in the tank to get us to that gas station, sometimes up to 20 more miles. But even though the screen says E, nope, there's still more in us.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Graham, this has been such a, oh gosh, it's been such a good conversation. If there's like any, like, I mean, we talked about so many different things, right? But is there like any like main points that people who are listening really need to take away and go like, I need to do this now?
I think it's easy to be lazy thinking about the future. And, you know, as we talked, people are different in their own ways. Some people are probably very good at thinking about the future. Elon Musk, for example, I don't think has too much difficulty imagining, you know, people living on Mars and what that's going to look like. He maybe has a little bit more difficulty about finding people to execute that for him. But in general, you know, we do have this psychological allergy to uncertainty. And it's, we normally feel that the most. We normally shy away from the future just as we should be leaning into it. And so if you're feeling like, you know, you don't want to think about something, it's always the most difficult futures we avoid thinking about. And I, even though I know this, I've done this so many times myself, is, you know, I don't really want to do that thing. And so I don't really think it through properly. And then I just kind of stumble into it. And I'm like, oh, no, this really is a terrible situation now. I wish I'd done something a little bit different to make this a better experience. So I would say, you know, be aware of those situations where you're being kind of pushed away from thinking about the future, or you find it a little bit, you're being repelled from it, and take that opportunity to look into the dark hole, see what the future really does hold. And then you'll feel much more confident that you'll have control over your future and that you've done all you can to make life a little bit nicer for your future self.
Take a walk in the dark side. Or the wild side. Maybe both, dark and wild. Graham, like, where can people find more about you, learn about your work, have you speak to their team? Like, where can people connect with you?
Absolutely. You can find me on LinkedIn. My name is Graham Norris. You can find me on LinkedIn there, based in the UK Maidenhead. And you can also find me on my website, which is grahamnorris.me.
Graham, this has been such a pleasure, and I definitely hope that people reach out to you. I've enjoyed our conversation, and we're just kind of scratching the surface on this issue. And I know heavens knows you could talk hours about on this subject.
I love the love the questions you asked me. It got me thinking a little bit more deeply as well. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, that's the point of this conversation. So guys, if you've been listening to this conversation, if you really enjoyed it, obviously, I hope you've written down notes, because just listening to this ain't enough. So you've written something down, you're reflecting about, you're going to go back and take an action step, whatever that looks for you in your situation, personally or professionally. Take the next step, share this podcast, write a review, let other people know what you're doing. Spread the message further that change starts with a changed mindset. And with that being said, Graham, thank you again. Thank you guys for listening. Make sure that you take initiative, because without you, nothing in this world will get better. Until next time, take care and be awesome.